Hello everyone, welcome to Blood Ties. I'm Geoffrey Wonsall, and I'm afraid I'm on my own today because Molly is out otherwise engaged on doing many important things. So this is a solo. In fact, there are going to be two solos this week and next week. So there's plenty to look forward to. I'm going back into the theatre quite shortly to do the show I did with David Suchet on tour and then in the West End. So we're going to the Hampstead Theatre to do it again for 18 performances, which I think will be fun. I'm also trying to put together more Patreon material for you, which I'm very conscious I haven't been doing enough of, but I'll do that too. So with your forbearance and a bit of good luck, I should be able to entertain you. But most of all, of course, I should thank you for being there. Thank you for listening. Thank you for taking so much trouble and so much time to support me and Molly in this extraordinary world of podcasting, which when we started back in 2017, it was comparatively small. But now it's, of course, enormous, which is rather wonderful in a way. For some elderly gent like me, it's a quite extraordinary privilege to be there with you. But thank you for your support, as they say. So today's story, which as I said is going to be in two parts, concerns one of the most horrible, brutal, vicious, extraordinary men in modern British criminal history. I think one detective described him memorably as the most ruthless man I ever met. And his name was Kenneth Regan. But his nickname was Captain Cash. So this is the story of Captain Cash. Kenneth Regan was born Kenneth Avery in Ealing in London. There's various suggestions about his date of birth. The one I think I believe most is he was born in 1953. He was an intimidating man who had the most frightening stare. He could literally terrify people just by looking at them. He wasn't particularly tall, but he was very broad. He had a very firm, fierce face. If you look him up, you'll see what I mean. Avery, as he then was, made his name as a money launderer and a drug smuggler and a passport forger. In a period between 1990... and 1998, he was one of the most successful major drug dealers in Britain. He smuggled the drugs, he laundered money, he obtained fake passports on an enormous scale. I think at one point he brought in cannabis, 15 tons of cannabis worth 40 million into the UK. And to do it, he equipped himself with a miniature custom-built submarine. But in fact, that particular game didn't work, and they never quite got that in. But certainly, there's no question at all that he was a very, very rich, very powerful drug dealer, money launderer. He used a front, which was an insurance firm based in London's Regent Street, called Ceres International. And he used that to launder about £10 million worth of drug profits. He was smart, clever, and utterly ruthless. But he also loved the high life. My goodness me, did he love it. He had a string of big Mercedes, big black Mercedes, in which he liked to boast that he always kept huge amounts of cash in the boot. He was in every way living the gangster lifestyle. Now, I don't admire gangsters and never have, and I don't often talk about them, but Regan was so utterly terrifying and so utterly ruthless that it's difficult to ignore him. It was the bags of cash in the boot that earned him the nickname Captain Cash. Always big rolls of 20s or 50s in his pocket. Always money in the boot of the Mercedes. He had a big house in Ringwood in the New Forest. He lived the high life. He was completely relaxed about fake passports. He and a colleague who became his accomplice, William Hornsey, who was born in 1952 in North London. It was said that over a period of 10 years that they probably moved about 1,000 passports, fake passports. It was there as sort of insurance policy in case anything went wrong. It would supply them to drug mules. They would just buy them to drug suppliers. It was a complete one-stop shop that Regan and Hornsey were running. He was flamboyant and given to excess. In 1997, he met a woman called Belinda Bruin, who was a PR lady. And he met her actually in the bar at the top of Harvey Nichols' store in Knightsbridge. And he became smitten. He absolutely deluged her with presents, Cartier watches, and took her to the Monaco Grand Prix and helicopter rides. It was a real fling. Bluin knew nothing about his criminal past or his criminal present, for that matter, as far as any of us can tell. She was simply overwhelmed by the attention. And attention it certainly was. And things were going swimmingly for Regan, who at that point was still called Kenneth Avery. But in June 1998, things took a turn for the worse. The police raided Captain Cash and he tried to escape. It was an armed police raid. And typical of Regan, sorry, Avery as he still then was, he attempted to run down a policewoman in an attempt to get away. It didn't work. And he was indeed captured. Now, here comes the really terrifying bit. Regan decides, because he was a forever wily man, decides that he's not going to risk 20 years, which is what he was looking at for the large quantities of heroin that they found on him and all the rest. He decides that he's going to turn himself into a supergrass. He's going to turn Queen's evidence. Well, the police, to some extent, could hardly believe their luck, because he'd been involved in almost every major conspiracy involving cannabis and cocaine for the last 10 years. So Avery, as he then was, still was, strikes a deal with the Crown Prosecution Service and the police, that he will help them break up 4 or 5 major drug operations in the UK. He was interviewed 15 times by officers from what was then called the National Criminal Investigation Squad, and gave them elaborate and intricate information about a £100 million cocaine smuggling ring, which led to the conviction of a dozen top criminals and the confiscation of millions of pounds of drugs. The officer had been working on the investigation into this cocaine smuggling for several years, and as a result of Avery's cooperation, no fewer than 15 people were convicted in a case which involved five separate trials. Regan's co-defendants, because of course he was a defendant himself, pleaded not guilty, but thanks to him, they received lengthy sentences. Well, it was, you might say, a turning point. Regan, the majority of his co-defendants got 20 years, Regan got 4, and he'd already served a period of on remand during which he was questioned by the NCIS. And at the trial, the judge told Regan, then still Avery, as a result of your cooperation, you will never again be trusted by your former colleagues, so you can't go back to a life of crime. And the enmity of those people will make your future life precarious. Those who turn against their former associates should receive a very great reduction in their sentence. As a result of that, Regan was given 8 years, not 20. And indeed, he was released just 3 years after the trial, in 2002, having served just half his 8-year sentence. It was at that point that Kenneth Avery decided to become Kenneth Regan. Now, I've always believed that he chose the name Regan as a sort of joke based on the ITV cop show, The Sweeney, because you may recall Jack Regan, played memorably by John Thor, was the principal flying squad officer in the series. I think Regan chose that name because of John Thor's performance in The Sweeney. He also changed his name, obviously, to avoid instant recognition by former associates. But it's very interesting. I mean, people, one former fellow prisoner who served that 4 years with him, once remarked, he knew there were contracts on his life, but he didn't seem to care. His attitude was, come on then, let's get it over with. There was no way he was going to live quiet. Believe me, when he goes, Regan will go out with a bang. Well, Regan is now desperate to become Captain Cash again, to regain, get back to being the flashy, exciting, flamboyant character that he'd been portraying for all these years. And he was going to find a way of doing it. One of the people whom Kenneth Regan, as he now was, had grassed up, given information to the police about, was his old friend and associate, William Hornsey. But that did nothing to affect Hornsey's immense loyalty to Regan. Even though he'd cost him a period of time in prison, he didn't seem to mind. He was devoted. Hornsey had been born, I think it was in Windsor, not in London. And sometimes he had used the name William South, but his name was actually Hornsey. Well, Regan, who is nothing if not versatile, gets a job after he leaves prison in 2002 driving a heavy goods vehicle. He was prepared to do almost anything on the road to getting back to his millionaire lifestyle, back to drug smuggling, back to passports, back to money laundering. And he went to work for a firm based in Heston, not far from London Airport. It was a firm called Ciba, which effectively imported fruit and vegetables in trucks. Well, what more perfect place could there be to put your hand on a good cover, a good front for money laundering and drug smuggling? Ciba had been set up by an Indian businessman called Anjit Chauhan. He was always known as Anil or Neil Chauhan. He was a slightly feckless and had trouble with the tax authorities in the past, for which he'd served a small amount of time in prison. But nevertheless, he was the perfect target for Regan. Regan is driving a truck for Ciba, and he thinks to himself, clearly, I wonder if this wouldn't be something I could take over. I don't know why nobody much liked him in the business, and Anil Chauhan's wife certainly didn't like him. Few people did. One friend of Chauhan said, why was he involved with a man like that? Regan is a thug. He crashed his lorry into a car driven by a friend of mine down at the yard the other day. When my friend pointed out the damage, Regan fixed him with his terrifying stare and said, you didn't see anything. Nothing happened, dear. My friend drove away fast. It was as though Regan was just simply warming up, rippling his muscles to see if he couldn't take over Ciba. But he had to come up with a plan. So the plan he envisaged also involved there being one or two accomplices, one of whom was his old passport smuggling friend, William Hornsey, and the other was a man called Paul Rees. Now, Paul Rees was a friend of Hornsey's. Hornsey had known him in Bridport, in Dorset, and Rees had moved to Portsmouth, but they kept in touch. Rees was, I suppose you could say, a little suggestible. He had three children. He was a car salesman, as well as a roofer and a plasterer, and a small-scale, low-level criminal. A little burglary, a little handling stolen goods. But he wasn't a gangster in Regan or Hornsey's mould. There was no doubt that he provided the perfect pair of strong shoulders and big hands that Regan needed. So at the beginning of 2003, Regan, the truck driver, starts telling Anajit, to give him his correct first name, Amarjit Chauhan, that he's got a Dutch buyer who is anxious to take over the firm, and he realises also that Chauhan has one or two, shall we say, difficulties, and then he's quite keen to sell the business. Chauhan is not at all convinced, not surprisingly, because after all this is a man who's driving one of his trucks. But nevertheless, Regan continues to woo him with memories of this stories about these Rutchbackers. At this point, Regan is living with his father in his father's house in Salisbury in Wiltshire. Number 3 Forge Close, I think it was. And going driving the trucks. Finally, Regan persuades Shohan to come and meet his, quotes, Dutch buyer at a meeting in Stonehenge in Wiltshire, not far from Salisbury. It's near Amesbury, but it's still not far. It's February 2003. And on that Thursday, February the 13th, Shohan agrees to meet the so-called Dutch investor who's going to buy him out. And the meeting takes place near Stonehenge. Shohan drives from his business, Heston, near the airport, near Heathrow Airport, down to Stonehenge, down the A303. But the man that he's meeting is not a Dutch buyer. It is actually Bill Hornsey's friend, Peter Rees. The three men, Regan, Hornsey and Rees, abduct Anil Shohan, throw him in their car and drive him to Regan's father's house in Salisbury. They drug him. They torture him because they want him to sign all sorts of documents which are going to be used for Regan to take over the SIBA business. They include, for example, a power of attorney. Shohan must have been terrified, absolutely terrified. He's being kept prisoner. He's being asked to sign pieces of paper, blank. I think he signed 28 blank pieces of paper. He must have been in fear for his life. Now, clearly, Regan's original idea was simple. We'll just get Shohan to sign various fake documents. I'll take over the company, and I'll say that Shohan is in fear for his life and has fled back to India. Well, that might have worked, but for the fact that Shohan was exceptionally close to his wife. She was young. She was called Nancy. They had two children, little ones. They had an 18-month-old toddler called Davinder, an 8-week-old baby brother called Ravinder. And at the time, Nancy's mother, Charanjit Kaur, who was 52, was visiting the family from India. There are some very, very touching pictures of the family on the Murderpedia site. If you look up Kenneth Regan, you'll find a photo gallery. They were upright, charming, cheerful. Yes, I suspect Anil himself was a little flaky, but still, they were a lovely family. And there's some wonderful pictures of the husband and wife and their two little boys. And indeed, Anil's mother-in-law. But once Shohan had gone off the radar, this trip to Stonehenge, his wife, not surprisingly, kept phoning him on his mobile phone, which of course went straight to voicemail because he didn't have it. And she became increasingly concerned. Now, she in turn was very close to her brother. Now, her brother lived in New Zealand. And He was called Onkar Verma. And they were so close indeed that they used to speak to each other on the telephone almost every day. Well, Anil disappears on a Thursday. By the end of Friday, Nancy is very, very worried indeed, and she mentions the fact that she's worried about Anil to Anwar on the phone to New Zealand. I don't think at that point, in fact I'm certain at that point, Regan had any idea at all of just how close Nancy was to her brother. But, and here's the dreadful but, on the Saturday, the 15th of February, 2003, Regan and Hornsey get into a van, which they've hired, and drive to Chohan's house, where they were determined to kill the remaining members of Anil Chohan's family. What happened afterwards sends more than a shiver down my spine. It sends a positive tremor. Became one of the most ghastly acts of bestiality that I can possibly imagine. But that's the end of part one of Captain Cash. Thank you for listening. Thank you to all the people who help Molly and I do these podcasts. Thank you to Sam Brain, our producer, to my son Dan, Molly's brother, for doing the music, to George for doing the caricatures, to Audio Boom for hosting us. But most of all, thanks to you, the listeners. Thank you for being there. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you for listening for all these years. It's a terrifying story, and it underlines just how often and so why I always say bad things happen to good people. So do be careful out there.